far away.
Okay. Hi, Tom. Hi, Brian. Thank you so much for having me on the podcast. I'm a big
fan. Thanks for coming.
Yeah.
We're delighted to have you.
Thank you. I'll go ahead and introduce myself, Andrea Apollo. I'm a medical oncologist at the National Cancer Institute in Bethesda, Maryland, in the USA.
And Andrea, yeah, thanks for joining us. We've heard that your ambassador study was positive. I don't remember when that announcement was. It was a number of months ago, right?
Yes. It was a press release. We said, you know, one of the endpoints, the disease-free survival, met its endpoint. So, you know, there was a press release for that.
And so I think we know sort of the background and rationale, and obviously we're aware of the CheckMate adjuvant Nivo data, but maybe just dive into what you presented, you know, in terms of design and patients, and then obviously we'll talk about the outcome.
We're so excited about this, Andrea, by the way. I've been excited about this for a long time, I can tell you. I'm finding it hard to keep myself under control.
Thank you for adding that critical information, Tom. Thank you for that.
I am really excited, genuinely.
Thank you, Tom. I'm also excited. This is like one of my children. So it's been going on for so long. So I feel very close to this study. And I'm so happy to be able to present the data. So I'll tell you a little bit of background about the Ambassador study. It's an adjuvant phase 3 trial run by the cooperative group, the Alliance of Adjuvant Pembrolizumab versus Observation in Patients with Muscle-Invasive Urothelial Carcinoma. And these are high-risk patients that have persistent muscle-invasive disease after neoadjuvant therapy, or that were not eligible to receive neoadjuvant chemotherapy and had T3-4 positive surgical margins or lymph node positive disease. The primary dual endpoint were disease-free survival and overall survival. And we also present the DFS and OS secondary endpoint of PD-L1 status. The patients were randomized to receive pembrolizumab for 1 year versus observation, and we had the stratification factors of PD-L1 status, neoadjuvant chemotherapy, and pathologic stage.
And Andrea, the eligibility around path staging with or without neoadjuvant chemo is pretty similar to the adjuvant Nivo study. Is that right from memory?
It is very similar. Yeah. The only thing that we did allow is we allowed patients with positive surgical margins, and that's different and that's new. And we did not limit the number of upper tract patients that could enroll.
Got it.
But it was only about 2% with positive surgical margins. It was a small number, wasn't it?
It was a small number of patients that have positive surgical margins. Yeah.
And Andrea, what are you sure?
So we met the primary endpoint of disease-free survival with a hazard ratio of 0.69, showing a benefit for adjuvant pembrolizumab versus observation. The median disease-free survival was doubled using pembrolizumab versus observation, with 14 months versus 29 months for the patients receiving adjuvant pembrolizumab. We also showed overall survival data that's interim, not the final analysis, and it did not meet the endpoint of overall survival data. And we think that this has to do with a lot of the patients in the observation arm moving on to nivolumab or withdrawing from the study and then receiving nivolumab treatment at the time that nivolumab. So while the trial was running, nivolumab became FDA approved. And although we almost completed accrual, we got up to 96%. We did close as soon as nivolumab became approved for the same setting. This is the adjuvant setting for patients with muscle-invasive bladder cancer. We didn't think that it was appropriate to continue the trial with an observation arm where there was an FDA-approved treatment for patients with muscle-invasive bladder cancer.
And Andrea, just interrupting, apologize, Brian. Median follow-up of the trial and the hazard ratio for overall survival.
So the median follow-up was different for the patients based on, because we met the disease-free survival benefit first. So it was a little bit longer for the patients in the in the overall survival. So it was 22 months for the patient in the disease-free survival and 36 months for the overall survival.
And okay. you mentioned patients, I guess, randomized to observation who then went and got immune therapy. I'm looking at your consort diagram. You quantified that. I mean, it was a significant number or not?
It was a significant number, and a lot of patients were censored both for DFS and for overall survival. And, you know, when patients withdraw, a lot of these censored were because patients withdrew either from clinical follow-up or withdrew consent completely from the study. A lot of the patients that do withdraw are usually higher risk patients that are more likely to have recurrence or to die of their disease.
Andrea, what was the overall survival hazard ratio?
The overall survival ratio was 0.98.
0.98. It was about 25 months survival. What proportion of patients went on in the control arm to get subsequent immune therapy?
So I don't think that the study captured this well because of the patients that withdrew, but the patients that did not withdraw and went on to get subsequent therapy was about 30%.
What is the withdrawal issue in your mind? And is that different from other trials in this space?
I think that because it's an observation control arm, there is a higher number of patients that are withdrawing from the study, and we don't have any follow-up. So I understand patients go on to receive other therapies, but we could still potentially follow them. Unfortunately, a lot of patients withdrew consent because they thought they had to, and we don't have any follow-up data for a lot of the patients that withdrew.
Can we talk about censoring in your control arm and your censoring of your overall survival and your PFS curve, of your DFS curves? What was your censoring like? Because I know in the atezolizumab study, there was also quite a lot of heavy censoring. What does your censoring look like?
Yeah, so about 32% of the patients for the DFS were censored, and because they withdrew either clinical follow-up or withdrew consent from the study. That's versus 20% in the pembrolizumab treatment arm.
So that's, yeah, I mean, that strikes me as a pretty high number. I'm not sure I know the numbers across studies. And although it looks like for overall survival, it was like 16 versus 19%. So not a huge difference, at least in percentage. It doesn't tell you about timing, but at least in percentage that were censored. But those absolute numbers seem pretty high to me compared to other studies.
Yeah, I would agree with that.
Well, the atezolizumab, just if I may stop you, the atezolizumab... Please. Overall survival curve, if you look at that OS curve, the atezolizumab 0.85, you've got 0.98. In the atezolizumab study, actually, if you look at censoring, that's pretty heavy throughout as well. And one of the questions comes around whether or not, so for example, at 24 months, you've got less than half the patients in both arms at 24 months. It's about 45% of patients. But only about 70% are, so you've got only half the patients or less than half the patients, but the OS is over 70%. So you're missing 20% of the patients there as well. So I don't think this doesn't strike me, as you know, we haven't got the OS from Nevo, but the only other OS curve we do have also has pretty heavy censoring. Now that was an observation rather than a placebo study, but I don't see, and Andrea, you might be able to correct me on this, I don't see patients withdrawing consent to say, I'm happy to have my survival measured. I totally understand I've chosen to have a different therapy. I don't want to take part in the trial. But most patients in my experience don't say, oh, and you can't phone me up and find out if I'm still alive. That seems to me a very unusual event for me.
I agree. And I don't know if it had to do with the monitoring or the education from the sites. Remember, this was open in a large number of community sites. And when I received multiple emails when nivolumab became approved saying we're withdrawing consent, I would email them right back. You don't have to withdraw consent. We'll still follow you. But at that point it was too late. And, you know, the patients had been, basically they were just telling me, the sites were just telling me, this is what we did, but they had already been removed from the study. And I agree, we could have easily followed those patients. And I feel like it's a loss that we weren't able to do that.
Andrea, I have a question about the PD-L1 status subsets. If I remember correctly, both DFS and OS seem to be the opposite of what I would expect, whereas the hazard ratio was lower in PD-L1 negative.
Are you expecting the biomarker works? Because if you expect the biomarker,
to be perfect, but I'm expecting perfect. It to at least trend in the right direction.
Do you not? Have you listened to any of our podcasts, Brian? What do you do when I'm talking? Have you got something going on? Tom,
I have to agree with Brian. I was really shocked, and I had to look at the coding four times,
right?
Because I said, "Is this possible?" Like, did we get it wrong? So the biomarker does not discriminate, and the pembrolizumab had a benefit in both in the PD-L1 positive and in the PD-L1 negative, but right. The largest benefit was in the PD-L1 negative, so right. That was a little surprising to me.
In the
in 361, Brian, in 361, chemo pembro versus chemo, the hazard ratio
that has
the biomarker enriched for chemotherapy for the placebo group. The hazard ratio was better for the CPS biomarker. This is a CPS biomarker.
Yes.
Now, we need to move away from this PD-L1 tool. PD-L1 expression doesn't exist. PD-L1 is a plethora of different biomarkers. You've got TC expression, you've got IC expression, you've got 5%, you've got 10%. You've got, so the TC.
I'm sorry, I asked the question now. So
the PD-L1, this is exactly what happened in 361. This is where we are. This is what we can expect. The PD-L1 biomarker doesn't work in urothelial cancer and doesn't exist.
Okay.
It's TC or IC.
So it was prognostic. The patients that were PD-L1 high had a better outcome both for DFS and for OS for the CPS greater than 10%.
Right. So putting aside the predictive value, which I agree is suspect in different definitions, although it's still surprising despite what you say.
Suspect.
Prognostically, wouldn't you expect PD-L1 positive patients to do worse? However defined?
If we defined them by the PD-L1 positivity being in the tumor, but when you include the immune cells, I feel like if you have a lot of immune cells and you're picking up PD-L1 positivity in them, I feel like that actually helps the patient in terms of their outcome. There's a lot of immune cells there.
Yeah.
And I think that patients generally tend to do better in that setting.
Because, Brian, if you have immune cell component, those patients, that's a representation of antigen-presenting cells, and those patients are going to have a better prognosis. And because they've got a better prognosis, they're going to have less events. And if they have less events, the hazard ratio may be better.
Yeah, and so, that's what we also saw in the atezolizumab study with the IMvigor010, right? We saw the patients.
Yeah, because they measure biomarker,
but they're exclusively measuring immune cells.
Immune cells, exactly. Yeah, exactly. Next question, Brian. Next question. upper tract tumors. Let's go with that.
I was
quickly.
Just about to say upper tract. Yeah. So there were a pretty good chunk of upper tract,
20%.
Something like in this study. And again, you know, subset analysis aside, it reinforces what's been seen in the Nevo study where they didn't appear to have benefit. Do you agree?
I would agree, and I don't know why, and it was disappointing because I was hoping that this study would show that there is a benefit to giving adjuvant checkpoint inhibition, but it was very similar to what we saw with the nivolumab study in that the hazard ratio really was 1. And there was no benefit. Now, this was a smaller number of patients, and I think this is multifactorial. I think number one, upper tract patients have a different biology. And number two is there is no standard in terms of the lymph node dissection that these patients have. Some do, some don't. And, you know, lymph node dissections can be not only diagnostic, but also therapeutic. And a lot of these patients don't get neoadjuvant chemotherapy too. And it seems that the patients that received neoadjuvant chemotherapy had a really one of the better benefits, although it was very similar in my study. But I think it's multifactorial, but you know, patients with upper tract disease tend to have a deficiency in mismatch repair genes and also MSI high. So I would think that they would be responding better to immunotherapy in this setting than you would see with standard bladder cancer, but we're not seeing that.
Anything toxicity wise that stood out? It looks like it was pretty much as expected.
No, it was pretty much as expected. There was nothing that stood out in terms of the toxicity. Very well tolerated.
Andrea, the atezolizumab study had a hazard ratio of 0.89, 0.85 for disease-free survival OS. The biomarker didn't work. A proportion of patients in that trial did get subsequent therapy. We've moved on from atezolizumab. But we also have the 274 study with adjuvant nivolumab. This was against placebo rather than observation, but it had a similar, I've got a data cut with a similar follow-up period, similar disease-free survival to yours, 0.70. The median overall survival, the PFS of the control arm is not that different. The DFS is 14 months. I think they're 11 months. So it's a similar population. We're not going to talk about their PD-L1 biomarker. We've already explained it's different, and therefore one can expect a different result with that. They also showed the same trend in upper tract disease, and the forest plot wasn't that dissimilar. We've not seen overall survival, but we have seen subsequent immune therapy in 25% of the patients, or 24% of patients with the immune therapy arm. The big elephant in the room, I guess, is we now have two big randomized trials in adjuvant urothelial cancer, one with pembrolizumab with a hazard ratio OS of 0.98. Can we expect exactly the same from nivolumab?
That's a great question. And I don't know, but we haven't seen it, and it's been a long time. And why haven't we seen the overall survival results? Some studies statistically are not allowed to show you the data until the final analysis, or they write it in a certain way. And we're not showing, this is not the final analysis for us for overall survival, and whether, there's going to be a benefit with more events. I would hope so. I don't know. But this is an interim analysis for us. And they've presented their data, I want to say it was 3 years ago now, and we still haven't seen an overall survival outcome reported. So whether we're going to see it or not, I don't know. I think there is a benefit to giving it with the DFS benefit. I think there's a lot of confounders here for us. They had, less confounders because it was a placebo study, less dropouts, which is a little cleaner, I think. But I'm also surprised that we still have not seen the survival data.
Do you think, and this is the key question, do you think the pendulum at the moment, or the position, should be, until we see that positive overall survival signal, we should assume it's negative because the two previous trials have come up as negative? That would be the glass half empty approach. Or do you think we should say, well, we haven't seen it yet, it could be positive, let's make the assumption it's going to be positive and go with that? Which should be our default position? The same as the other two trials, where overall survival, it should be relatively easy to collect, should be similar. We all think pembrolizumab is a good drug. Do we think that, therefore, the nivolumab should therefore be negative? Until we do see it, we should assume it's negative? Or should we give them the benefit of the doubt and say, well, it's got an FDA approval, and therefore we can assume it's positive until we see otherwise?
I'm usually a glass half full person, but I think there's a reason we haven't seen it yet.
I mean, I guess I would, a couple comments. First of all, thanks for showing the survival data, right? I mean, I think it's important to see the whole picture. I think you could reasonably argue that DFS is enough benefit and that you'd love to have OS, but it's not mandatory. I think, that's another position. If you look at your OS curves, the pembro is tracking above pretty consistently until you get right to your median point of follow-up at 36 months.
0.98.
No, I understand, Tom. But yeah. I mean, I guess it really comes down to, do you have to have overall survival to use the drug, right? I don't personally believe so. It's not that you don't want it, of course. And my position would be, yeah, there's no reason to believe it's going to be positive, right? To state it a different way, because you have an almost identical DFS benefit, similar drug, similar eligibility, similar duration of therapy. There's no major differences. You have more upper tract here. I mean, there are some differences, but I wouldn't call them major differences. So it's hard to postulate that OS hazard ratio is going to be 0.7 and statistically significant. We'd all be surprised with that result.
But Brian, you're putting more than 50% of patients who don't need the drug because they're going to be cured by the surgery, you're giving them a 10% chance of life-changing side effects.
No, I understand, with no survival.
So just saying progression-free survival will go with it without overall survival. You have to bring adverse events into that equation.
Of course. I mean, I get benefit and risk, right? I mean, and I'm not saying you should give it to everybody regardless.
So Mr. Jones could have had his operation.
He's had renal cancer before there was survival data.
We had an OS hazard ratio of 0.53.
Before there was statistically significant. Yeah,
not 0.98, 0.53. So and that conversation can happen with me. But I think it would be reasonable at this point to say, you know what? It doesn't look like there's survival associated with adjuvant pembrolizumab or adjuvant atezolizumab. We haven't seen the volumab yet. Whereas before, I think you could say with adjuvant renal, you can say 0.53 looks provocative. And you and I chatted about this before, and about half the patients went for it and half the patients didn't. I mean, I don't think anyone was saying this is, you know, we've solved the adjuvant renal cancer issue yet with an interim analysis. But that 0.53 has translated into a significant survival benefit. We're now saying we've had two negative trials. It seems unlikely that the nivolumab will translate to that. So, and we should be having that conversation with our patients. Yeah. We're going to be giving you a drug. There's a 50% chance you won't need it. And it isn't associated. It probably isn't going to be associated with survival. And that's a different conversation.
I agree with everything you said.
Well, that's unusual.
Tom, I totally agree with what you're saying. I think it's really important to disclose this data to the patients. And that's one of the reasons that we're showing this data is so patients are aware that there is a disease-free survival benefit similar to what we saw with adjuvant nivolumab, but we have not yet seen a survival benefit. Now, again, it's not final analysis. This is an interim analysis, but we don't have survival benefit yet. So is there... Is should we be treating our patients with the adjuvant setting in the adjuvant? And I give adjuvant nivolumab right now. And I think it's really hard for patients to sit around and not do anything. And there is a disease-free survival benefit. So I offer it to patients. I have the discussion that we don't have overall survival data. And I will continue to have the same discussion with adjuvant pembrolizumab.
And the DFS benefit is pretty substantial. I mean, your median is double. Now, your median is longer than your follow-up, so there's some uncertainty around that estimate, but it's not like 2 months or one scan interval, right? I mean, it's a pretty good absolute benefit the way the data stands now. So again, you can argue that that's meaningful or less meaningful, and I'm sure it's different for different patients and docs, but it's not inconsequential in my opinion.
And Andrea, has the FDA or the EMA got this right? We there's the hazard ratio of 0.53, you know, that could translate to a survival benefit. And, you know, that we don't know yet, which is disappointing, but that could translate to survival. If it's 0.53 in the PD-L1 positives, do you have enough faith in that PD-L1 biomarker to say we should be using it? Or do you just think this is a black swan event that eventually, if we do enough trials with enough biomarkers, eventually one will come up that's positive? So who's got it right, the EMA or the FDA?
So I'm going to say I want to have the option to discuss it with my patient and be able to give it to them. So I think the FDA has it right. And I think that we should, right now, we don't know enough to say we have a biomarker, and if you have this biomarker, you should receive it. I think we over-treat a lot of patients, and that's why we need these trials to be so large, is because we're treating everybody after surgery. We're treating these high-risk patients, but a lot of patients may be cured and may not need it. So I think that's where the benefit gets diluted out. So I'm really excited about the trials that are ongoing right now using the ctDNA biomarker to assess, to see who really needs this. And you know, can we better select the patients and treat a smaller number of patients with these adjuvant therapies?
Andrea, you've got some exploratory work going on, and you've pre-specified that. We didn't talk about your statistical analysis plan, and I do love a good chat about statistical analysis, honestly, I really do. But I've spared our audience that anyway, moving on. You have allocated alpha. It was quite an unusual alpha allocation in your study across the board. But there was, if I'm interpreting correctly, you have allocated some alpha to some of these subset analysis, PD-L1 positives and negatives. What ctDNA analysis are you doing? And are you allocating alpha to that?
So we actually had to, this study was a hierarchical study design where we shared the alpha between DFS and OS. And if it met these, then it went to the secondary endpoints of PD-L1 positivity, negativity, versus DFS and OS. But because we had the DFS results, we didn't know the OS results. It hadn't met the OS endpoint, we had to, in order to present the data, we weren't technically allowed to present the data. We had to decouple the DFS with the OS in terms of this hierarchical approach. So it's a lot of statistical complexity within this trial. But the point is right now that we had to put an amendment in order to be able to show the DFS and the interim OS data. So for the ctDNA, I'm actually really excited. We're doing two assays, and I think this is really kind of fun that I'm able to do this. We're going to be using the Signatera assay, and we're also going to be using the Foundation One tracker. So we'll be using both of those, and we have multiple endpoints allocated for both of these, including is it prognostic? Is it predictive? Does it clear? How earlier does it clear than scans? We have five different time points. So, you know, that is ongoing right now, and, you know, I'm looking forward to the results of that.
Yeah, I mean, super important to compliment Tom's work and others, you know, in this space. And I think all of us have this belief that that's going to really, you know, we have these debates about we're treating people who don't need it and all this stuff. And I think, you know, at least my hope is ctDNA is going to really clarify that, you know, and do more to sort of advance this than any sort of new drug.
And I'm really happy that Tom and Matt are both doing trials prospectively incorporating ctDNA as an integral biomarker and making decisions based on this. I think it's important. And I like that Matt Gowski's study, it's also an Alliance study, intensifies the treatment if you are ctDNA positive. So I do think that although checkpoint inhibitors are active, I do think that in certain patients, you may need to intensify the treatment in order to really get a hold of the disease.
Andrea, they're going to be people who are going to come up to you, or kind of, they might probably won't come up to you, they'll probably come up to other people who are going to say, you know, the problem with the Ambassador study is all these patients withdrew, nivolumab became available. In the end, it just wasn't powerful enough and we lost too much. We can't really tell much from it. And therefore, we should set it to one side and continue with the randomized nivolumab study until proven otherwise. What does the Ambassador study, with all of the caveats that you've talked about, push back on that comment?
I think the Ambassador study, again, shows us that checkpoint inhibitors are active in this setting. And, you know, you can argue that it's not OS, it's DFS, but I think it's still a very important clinical endpoint for our patients to delay the recurrence of disease. And it does it just as well as nivolumab. The hazard ratios were very similar. It was 0.69 for us, 0.7 for nivolumab. So very, very similar. And I think there is a benefit to adjuvant checkpoint inhibitor therapy in these patients.
I've got my last question, if I may. EV pembro is associated with a 30% CR rate. It's associated with a doubling in progression-free survival, and a doubling in overall survival, significant survival benefit. Adjuvant nivolumab doesn't have that survival signal, and you were over-treating 50% of patients. In much of the world, it won't be possible to sequence immune checkpoint inhibition. And indeed, it may be that there's something active between EV and pembro, meaning giving them together is beneficial and better than, you know, than not giving them together. And that 30% CR rate might point towards that. Would you still want to give adjuvant nivolumab if you were not subsequently able to give EV pembro to those patients who progress?
That's a difficult question. I think that we may not get a chance for a lot of the patients, and, you know, treating patients earlier, a lot of patients do really, really well with treating them earlier. So I think we need to design trials where, again, like I was mentioning before, we intensify treatment for certain patients. And I think infortimab and vedotin in combination with pembro needs to be moved earlier within clinical trials. And we need to assess, can we cure patients earlier? Right now, I would still give adjuvant checkpoint inhibition, because I do think that there's a benefit for that for the patients.
Would either of you do an EV pembro adjuvant, or is the EV part, dependent on
No,
having
we don't have
tumor
data yet.
bulk?
That would be too early to do that. I think I understand
Would you do a
the
trial?
rationale.
That is what I was asking. Would you?
Yes,
Yeah.
I would absolutely do a trial. I think
Yeah.
it's a trial is important. And then also, what about giving it in the neoadjuvant setting? And I know the
Yeah.
trials are ongoing right now. I don't know if you necessarily need the sandwich approach. If you already accomplish a pathologic CR, do you need to give
Right,
adjuvant
right.
EV plus pembro? I don't think so. And for that matter, if you did not respond, why would you give more in the adjuvant setting if you didn't respond in a neoadjuvant setting? But I do think we need to incorporate these combinations that have shown such a great survival benefit into earlier states of disease in the perioperative setting, and it's being done.
Agreed.
I think my
Andrea?
take is slightly different. I think that I'm anxious about giving an adjuvant therapy to unselected patients in the knowledge that half of them don't need it, in knowing that those patients who relapsed in these trials didn't get EV pembro, and we still were unable to show OS. And I would like to see more active, I'd like to see an OS signal before I'm going to really be bought into this adjuvant therapy for all. I think the ctDNA analysis that you're doing is going to turn out to be incredibly important. I hope you're going to show that if we select those patients with MRD and we leave those patients alone who don't need adjuvant therapy, that that principle of earlier treatment is better is going to win the day. And in the end, it might be those MRD patients do need escalation beyond single agent immune checkpoint inhibition, because deep down, I'm not sure that's great at getting control of disease. So I think that study you talked about with Matt, where he's giving the TIGIT, or sorry, the LAG-3 plus PD-1 in that population, but also EV pembro in those ctDNA positive patients, might be a really good way of eliminating this disease. I think it's really exciting. Andrea, investigator-initiated work's incredibly difficult. I remember being in a room in ASCO. I can't remember the hotel's name, but I remember you were there, and Jonathan, and a number of other people who have taken part in this. We were trying to get the EORTC on board.
Yes.
We wanted to do it. We regret not doing it. It was difficult. I
Well,
don't think it was entirely our fault,
no
but you
thanks to
have.
you, Tom, then these
Well,
data.
I did my best, but the reality is these are incredibly hard to do. And you guys need to be congratulated for this incredible work. I think it is incredibly important, informative data. I think this survival signal gives us a pause for breath. And I think your DFS signal is robust. And I think it shows that pembro is obviously as good a drug as any in this space. And I'm really ex I'm really I'm excited about the data, as I said before, but I think you've done an amazing job.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Yeah,
Thank you,
Andrea.
Tom,
Yeah, thanks for
Brian.
joining. We appreciate it. Thanks for your time.
My pleasure.
All right. See you soon.
Thanks all.
Take care. Bye.